another until they became one line. It was a doctrine he could not entirely credit, nor was he at all sure Ada would find his offer welcome, not from a man galled in mind as he had become. He concluded by saying that though Ada was somewhat thistleish in comportment, she was, by his way of thinking, very beautiful. Her eyes were downturned and set slightly asymmetrically in her head, and it gave her always a sad expression, which in his view only served to point up her beauty. The woman looked as if she thought Inman spoke the greatest foolishness she had ever heard. She pointed her pipe stem at him and said, "You listen. Marrying a woman for her beauty makes no more sense than eating a bird for its singing, but it's a common mistake nonetheless." They sat for a while without talking, just sipping the laudanum. It was sweet, and had thickened up so that it was not much runnier than sorghum, nor much clearer. It tasted like metheglin, though without the taste of honey, and it clung to the cup with such determination that Inman found himself licking it out. The rain came down harder, and a few drops made their way through the thatching of the arbor and hissed in the fire. It was a lonesome sound, the rain and the fire and nothing else. Inman tried to picture himself living similarly hermetic in just such a stark and lonesome refuge on Cold Mountain. Build a cabin on a misty frag of rock, and go for months without seeing another of his kind. A life just as pure and apart as the goat woman seemed to be. It was a powerful vision, and yet in his mind he saw himself hating every minute of it, his days poisoned by lonesomeness and longing. "It must get cold in winter up here," Inman said. "Cold enough. In the chilliest months I keep the fire hot and the blankets deep, and my biggest concern is that my ink and watercolors not freeze while I work at the desk. There are days so cold I sit with a cup of water between my legs to warm it, and then when I daub a wet brush in color, the bristles freeze before I can touch the tip to paper." "What is it you do in those books?" Inman said. "I make a record," the woman said. "Draw pictures and write." "About what?" Inman asked. "Everything. Goats, plants, weather. I keep track of what everything's up to. It can take up all your time just marking down what happens. Miss a day and you get behind and might never catch back up." "How did you learn to write and read and draw?" Inman asked. "Same way you did," she said. "Somebody taught me." "And you've spent your life this way?" "So far I have," she said. "I'm not dead yet." "Do you not get lonesome living here?" Inman said. "Well, now and again, maybe. But there's plenty of work, and the doing of it keeps me from worrying too much." "What if you get sick up here by yourself?" Inman said. "I've got my herbs." "And if you die?" The woman said that living with such great scope of privacy had some disadvantages. She knew she could not expect help under any circumstances, nor did she much want to live past the point where she could fend for herself, though she calculated that date still to be writ on a fairly distant calendar. Knowing she was likely to die alone and lie unburied did not trouble her a whit. When she felt death coming, she planned to stretch out at the top of the rock cliff and let the ravens peck her apart and carry her away. "It's that or worms," she said. "Of the two, I'd as soon have ravens carry me off on their black wings." The rain began falling harder yet, dripping fast through the roofing of the arbor. They called the evening concluded, and Inman crawled under the caravan and rolled up in his blankets and slept. When he woke, a day had passed, and night was again coming on. A raven sat perched on a spoke, looking at him. Inman got up and daubed his wounds with the salve, and ate his herb medicines, and took another draught of laudanum and liquor. The woman fixed him more of the bean and goat stew, and while he ate, they sat together on the caravan steps. The woman told a long and maundering tale of a goat-trading mission she had made down as far as the capital city once. She had sold half a dozen goats to a man, had the money in her hand, when she remembered that she wanted to take the bells back with her. The man declined, saying the deal was completed. She said the bells had never been part of the deal, but he called the dogs on her and ran her off. Late that night she had gone back with a knife and cut the leather collars and gotten the bells, and had, as she put it, walked out through the streets of the capital just a cussin'. Inman felt very foggy throughout the story, for he could feel the medicines working in him, but when she was done he reached over and patted the back of her etched and spotted hand and said, "The heroine of the goat bells." Inman slept again. When he awoke it was dark and no longer raining, but cold. The goats had crowded around him to get warm, and their smell was so sharp as to about make his eyes water. He had no idea if it was the same dark he had fallen asleep to, or whether a day had intervened. Light from a grease lamp fell in threads through cracks in the caravan floor, and so Inman crawled out and stood in the wet leaves on the ground. There was a shirt of moon part way up the eastern sky, and the stars all stood in their expected places and looked chill and brittle. At the ridge above the cove, an enormous pike of bare rock stood black against the sky, like a picket, watching for any siege the heavens might throw down. The strong urge to walk came over Inman. He went and knocked at the door, and waited for the old woman to let him in, but there was no answer. Inman opened the door and stepped inside and found the place empty. He looked about the desk at the papers. He picked up a journal and opened it to a drawing of goats. They had eyes and feet on them, like people, and the sentences of the entry below were hard to parse, but they seemed to contrast the behavior of certain goats on cold days to their behavior on hot. Inman leafed through farther and found pictures of plants, and then more pictures of goats, in every imaginable attitude, all done in a mute and limited palette, as if she painted with clothes dye. Inman read the stories that went with the pictures, and they told of what the goats ate and how they acted toward each other, and what mood seized them from day to day. It seemed to Inman that the woman's aim was to list in every detail the habits of their culture. This would be one way to live, Inman thought, a hermit among the clouds, the contentious world but a fading memory, mind turned only toward God's finer productions. But the more he studied the journal, the more he wondered how it must be for the woman to count back through the decades, figuring how many years had passed since some event in her youth, the romance with the yellow-haired farm boy she had wanted to marry instead of the old man, an autumn day of particular glory, a dance that evening after the harvest, later, out on the porch, an amber moon rising over the trees, kissing the boy with her lips parted, while inside fiddlers played a piece of ancient music to which she had attached an unreasonable enthusiasm. So many years gone between then and now that even the bare number would seem unutterably sad, even without some sweet attendant memory. Inman looked about and found there was not a scrap of mirror in the caravan, and he therefore assumed the woman must go about her grooming by feel. Did she even know her own recent countenance? Long hair as pale and fine as cobwebs, hide sagged and puckered and folded about her eyes and jowls, brindled across her brow, bristles growing from her ears, only her cheeks pink, the discs in her eyes still bright and blue. If you held a glass up to her, would she wrench back in surprise and fright at the relic looking out, her mind still grasping a picture of herself in an incarnation some decades previous? A person might get to such a state of mind, living so remote. Inman waited a long time for the goat woman to come back. Dawn rose, and he blew out the lamp and broke some sticks to put in the little stove. He wanted to get on, but he did not wish to leave without thanking her. She did not return until the morning was far advanced. She walked through the door with a brace of rabbits hanging limp from her grip on their hind legs. "I need to be going," Inman said. "I just wanted to see if I could pay you for the food and medicine." "You could try," the woman said, "but I wouldn't take it." "Well, thank you," Inman said. "Look here," the woman said, "if I had a boy, I'd tell him the same as I'm telling you. Watch yourself." "I will," Inman said. He turned to walk out of the caravan, but she stopped him. She said, "Here, take this with you," and she handed him a square of paper on which was drawn in great detail the globular blue-purple berry cluster of the carrion flower plant in autumn. Free Will Savages. At the first gesture of dawn, Ruby was up and out, on her way down to the house to fire up the stove and put on a pot of grits and fry up a few eggs. It was barely light enough to see, and the air was thick with the fog that pooled for an hour or two along the bottom of Black Cove on most mornings in all seasons but winter. But as she neared the house, she could make out a man in a dark suit of clothes standing by the corn crib. She walked straight to the kitchen porch and went inside and took the shotgun from where it rested, charged, in the crotch of two forked limbs nailed over the door frame. She pulled back both hammers and walked briskly toward the crib. The man wore a big gray slouch hat pulled low on his brow, and his head was tipped down. He was leaned with his shoulder to the crib wall, one leg crossed over the other and cocked up on its toe, casual as a traveler propped against a roadside tree waiting for a stage to come by, whiling away the time absorbed in his own thoughts. Ruby could see, even in the poor light, that the man was dressed in clothes of the finest material and making, and his boots, though somewhat scuffed, were more fit for a squire than a corn thief. Only one thing argued against the man's being utterly relaxed in his current posture. His right arm was entirely inside the hole in the chinking of the crib. Ruby walked right up to him, the shotgun held at a low angle, but nevertheless aimed at about his knees. She was ready to dress him down good for corn thieving, but when she neared the man, he tipped his head back to get the hat brim out of his line of sight. He looked at Ruby and grinned and said, "They hail fire." "So you're not dead," Ruby said. "Not yet," said Stobrod. "Set your daddy loose." Ruby propped the shotgun against the side of the crib and unlocked the door and went inside. She unstaked the trap from the dirt floor and pried open the jaws from around Stobrod's hand and walked back outside. Despite the padding, after he had withdrawn his arm from out the hole in the chinking, Stobrod stood and dripped blood from a cut to his wrist where the skin was thin over the bones. His forearm was bruised blue all around it. He rubbed it with his good hand. He took out a kerchief of fine linen and removed his hat and wiped at his forehead and neck. "Long night of standing here trapped," he said. "No doubt," Ruby said. She looked him over. He had changed some. He seemed such an old man standing there before her, his hair half gone from his head, whiskers grizzled. He had not filled out any, though. He was still just a little withy man. A quilting frame had more flesh to it. "How old are you now?" she said. He stood moving his mouth a little as he tried to do the figures in his head. "Maybe 45," he said eventually. 45, Ruby said. "About." "You don't look it," she said. "Thank you," he said. "I meant the other way." "Oh." "Anybody else," Ruby said, "I'd ask why you've been dipping our corn when you don't look hurting for money. But I know you better than that. You're going around getting a little here and a little there to run a batch of liquor, and you took that suit off somebody, or won it in a card game." "Well, something like," Stobrod said. "You've run off from the fighting, no doubt." "I was owed a furlough, being a hero, as I was." "You?" Ruby said. "Every battle I was in, I led the charge," Stobrod said. "I've heard it told that the officers like to run the greatest shitheels to the fore," said Ruby. "They get shut of them quicker that way." Then before Stobrod could answer, she said, "You come on with me." She picked up the shotgun and went to the house. She told him to sit on the porch steps and wait. Inside she lit the fire and put on a pot to make coffee. She mixed biscuit dough and rattled about putting breakfast together. Biscuits, grits, and eggs, a few strips of fried side meat. Ada came down and sat in her chair by the window and drank coffee, glum as usual in the early morning. "We finally caught something in that trap," Ruby said. "It's about time. What was it?" Ada asked. "My daddy." "He's out on the porch now," Ruby said. She was stirring a pan of white gravy made from the drippings of the side meat. "Pardon?" Ada asked. "Stobrod. He's made it home from the war. But dead or alive, he's of little matter to me. A plate of breakfast, and then we'll send him on his way." Ada rose and looked out the door at Stobrod's thin back, where he sat humped up on the bottom step. He held his left hand out before him, and he hummed to himself, and the fingers were working, tapping against the heel of his hand like a man doing psalms. "You might have asked him in," Ada said when she had returned to her chair. "He can wait out there." When breakfast was cooked, Ruby carried his plate to the table under the pear tree. She and Ada took their breakfast in the dining room, and they could see from the window that Stobrod ate quickly and with urgency, his hat brim bobbing in time with his chewing. He stopped just short of picking up his plate and licking the last skim of grease from it. "He could have eaten in here," Ada said. "That's where I draw the line," Ruby said. She went outside to collect his plate. "Have you got somewhere to go?" Ruby said to Stobrod. Stobrod told her that he did indeed have a home and a society of sorts, for he had fallen in with a collection of heavily armed outliers. They lived in a deep cave of the mountain like free-will savages. All they wished to do was hunt and eat and lay up all night drunk, making music. "Well, I guess that suits you," Ruby said. "Your aim in life always was to dance all night with a bottle in your hand. Now I've fed you. You can get on out of here. We've got nothing else for you. You go dipping our corn again, I might put a barrel of shot into you, and I don't load salt." She flapped her hands at him as if shoeing cattle, and he walked off at a saunter, hands in his pockets, taking a course toward Cold Mountain. The day that followed was warm and brilliant and dry. There had been nothing but one faint morning rain so far that month, and the leaves that had fallen and those yet on the trees were crisp as cold cracklings. They rattled aloft in the breeze and underfoot as Ruby and Ada walked down to the barn to see how the tobacco was drying. The broad leaves had been tied together at their stem ends, and they hung in rows upside down from poles strung underneath the shelter of the barn's cantilevered ends. There was something human and female and ominous in their flared hanging shapes, the bunched leaves fanning out like old yellowed cotton skirts. Ruby walked among them, touching the leaves, rubbing them between her fingers. She pronounced everything in fine order, owing to the favorably dry weather and to the care with which the tobacco was planted and harvested in accord with the signs. They would soon be able to soak it in molasses water and twist it into plugs and use it for trade. Ruby then proposed that they take a rest in the hayloft, a fine place for a sit-down, she said. She climbed the ladder and sat spraddle-legged in the wide hay door and dangled her feet into the open space below in a way that no other grown woman Ada knew would have done. Ada at first hesitated to join her. She sat in the hay with her legs under her and her skirts composed. Ruby looked at her with some amusement, as if to say, "I can do this because I never have been proper, and you can do it because you have recently quit being so." Ada went and sat at the hay door, too. They lounged and chewed on pieces of hay and swung their legs like boys. The big door framed the view uphill to the house and beyond across the upper fields to Cold Mountain, which looked close and sharp-edged in the dry air, all mottled with colors of autumn. The house looked pert, unsmudged white. A feather of blue smoke rose straight up from the black chimney pipe. Then a breeze swept down the cove and swirled it away. "You say you want to get to know the running of this land," Ruby said. "Yes," Ada said. Ruby rose and knelt behind Ada and cupped her hands over Ada's eyes. "Listen," Ruby said. Her hands were warm and rough over Ada's face. They smelled of hay, tobacco leaves, flour, and something deeper, a clean animal smell. Ada felt their thin bones against her fluttering eyes. "What do you hear?" Ruby said. Ada heard the sound of wind in the trees, the dry rattle of their late leaves. She said as much. "Trees," Ruby said contemptuously, as if she had expected just such a foolish answer. "Just general trees is all. You've got a long way to go." She removed her hands and took her seat again and said nothing more on the topic, leaving Ada to conclude that what she meant was that this is a particular world, until Ada could listen and at the bare minimum tell the sound of poplar from oak at this time of year, when it is easiest to do. She had not even started to know the place. Late that afternoon, despite the warmth, the light fell brittle and blue, and announced clearly in its slant that the year was circling toward its close. This was surely one of the last of the warm, dry days, and in its honor, Ada and Ruby decided to take supper outdoors at the table under the pear tree. They roasted a venison tenderloin that Esco had brought by, fried a skillet of potatoes and onions, and drizzled bacon drippings over some late lettuce to wilt it. They had brushed the brown leaves from the table and were just setting places for the two of them when Stavrod appeared from out the woods. He carried a tow sack, and he came and took a seat at the table as if he carried an invitation in his coat pocket. "You say the word, I'll run him off again," Ruby said to Ada. Ada said, "We have plenty." During the meal, Ruby refused to speak, and Stavrod engaged Ada in talk of the war. He wished it would end so he could come down off the mountain, but feared that it would drag on and that hard times would bear down upon everyone. Ada heard herself agree, but as she looked about her cove in the blue falling light, hard times seemed far away. When supper was done, Stavrod took his sack off the ground and drew from it a fiddle and set it across his knees. It was of novel design, for where the scroll would normally be was instead the whittled head of a great serpent curled back against the neck, detailed right down to the scales and the slit pupils of the eyes. It was clear Stavrod was proud as could be of it, and he had a right, for though the fiddle was far from perfect, he had fashioned it himself during the months of living fugitive. His previous instrument had been stolen from him during his trip home, and so, lacking a model, he had shaped the new one from memory of the fiddle's proportions, and it therefore looked like a rare artifact from some primitive period of instrument making. He turned it front and back so they could admire its faces, and he told them the story of its creation. He had spent weeks tramping the ridges to cut spruce and maple and boxwood, and when they were cured, he sat for hours on end knifing out fiddle parts. He cut forms and clamps of his own devising, boiled the wood of the side pieces soft, and shaped them so that when they cooled and dried they set to the forms in smooth curves that would not come unsprung. He carved the tailpiece and bridge and fingerboard freehand, boiled down deer hooves for glue, augured out holes for the tuning pegs, pieced it all together, and let it dry. Then he set the soundpost with aid of a wire, dyed the boxwood fingerboard dark with the juice of pokeberries, and sat for hours carving the viper's head curled over against its body. Finally, he stole a little tin of varnish from a man's tool shed in the dark of night and put the finish on it. Then he strung it up and tuned it, even went out one night and trimmed a horse's tail to hair his bow. He then looked upon his work and thought, "I've almost got my music now," for he had but one job left, the killing of a snake. For some time he had speculated that putting the tailpiece to a rattlesnake inside the instrument would work a vast improvement on the sound, would give it a sizz and knell like no other. The greater the number of rattles, the better, was his thinking on the matter. He described it along the lines of a quest. The musical improvement he was seeking would come as likely from the mystic discipline of getting the rattles as from their actual function within the fiddle. To that end, he had roamed Cold Mountain. He knew that in the first cool days of autumn the snakes were moving, in anticipation of winter, looking for dens. He killed a number of fair-sized rattlers, but once he had them dead, their little tails seemed pitifully insufficient. Finally, after climbing high up where the black balsams grow, he ran upon a great old timber rattler, laid out on a flat slate to sun. It was not enormous in length, for they did not get terribly long, but it was stouter through the body than the fat part of a man's arm. The markings on its back had all run together until it was black as a black snake almost. It had grown a set of rattles as long as Stobrod's index finger. In telling this to Ada, he held out the finger, and then with the thumbnail of the other hand he marked off a place right at the third knuckle. He said, "They was that long," and he snicked the nail repeatedly across the dry skin. Stobrod had walked up near the stone and said to the snake, "Hey, I aim to take them rattles." The big snake had a head like a fist, and it raised it up off the stone and evaluated Stobrod through slitted yellow eyes. It shifted into a park coil, declaring it would rather fight than move. The snake quivered its tail a moment, warming up. Then it went to rattling with a screech so dreadful as to make one's thinking seize up in all its units. Stobrod took a step back, as he was intended by nature to do. But he wanted those rattles. He drew out his pocket knife and cut a forked stick about 4 feet long and went back to the snake, which had not moved, and seemed to relish the prospect of a contest. Stobrod stood about arm's length outside what he judged the striking range to be. The snake perked up, raised its head further from the ground. Stobrod urged it to strike. "Whoo," he said, shaking the stick in its face. The snake rattled on, unfazed. "Wah," Stobrod said, poking at it with the fork. The rattling diminished a bit in volume and pitch as the snake shifted its coils. Then it fell silent, as if from boredom. The snake clearly required an offering of more substance. Stobrod eased forward, then crouched. He put the knife between his teeth and held the split sapling in his right hand, poised on high. He waved his left hand fast, well within striking distance of the snake. It lunged, parallel to the ground, its jaws unhinged, fangs down. The pink of its mouth looked big as the palm of an opened hand. It missed. Stobrod jabbed with the sapling and trapped the head against the rock. Moving fast, he set his foot to the back of the snake's head. He grabbed the thrashing tail, drew his knife from his mouth, cut the rattles off clean, right at the buttons, jumped back the way a cat will do when startled. The snake writhed, collected itself again into striking stance. It tried to rattle, though it had now but a bleeding stub. "Live on if you care to," Stobrod had said, and he walked away, shaking the rattles. He believed that from then on every note he bowed would have a new voice. In it, somewhere underneath, would be the dire keen of snake warning. After he had finished telling Ruby and Ada of the fiddle's creation, Stobrod sat and looked at it, as if it were a thing of wonder. He took the fiddle up and held it before them as an exhibit, part of a demonstration, intended to show that he was now another man in some regards than the one that went off to fight. Something about the war had made him and his music a whole different thing, he claimed. Ruby remained a skeptic. She said, "Before the war, you never showed more interest in fiddling than would be required to get a free drink for playing at a dance." "Some say I now fiddle like a man wild with fever," Stavrad said in his own defense. The revision in him had come unexpected, he said. It happened near Richmond in the month of January, 1862. The army he was with had set up winter quarters. One day a man had come into camp asking for a fiddler and was sent to Stavrad. The man said that his daughter, a girl of 15, had, in kindling the morning fire, done as she often did and poured coal oil down onto the fresh kindling. This morning, though, it had hit live coals and gone off in her face a moment after she had set the stove lid back into its place. The circle of cast iron had been blown with great force into her head, and the beam of fire that had come out of the opening had charred her flesh near to the bone. She was dying, that was certain. But she had come to consciousness after an hour or two, and when asked what might ease her passing, she answered that fiddle music would do fine. Stavrad took up his instrument and followed the man to his house, an hour's walk away. In the bedroom he found the family sitting around the perimeter of the room. The burn girl was propped up on pillows. Her hair was in patches, and her face looked like a skinned coon. The pillowcase was damp around her head where her raw hide had oozed. There was a deep gash above her ear where the stove lid had struck. The wound had stopped bleeding, but had not even turned brown yet. She looked Stavrad up and down, and the whites of her eyes were startling against the rawness of her skin. "Play me something," she said. Stavrad sat in a straight chair at the bedside and began tuning. He twiddled so long at the pegs that the girl said, "You best get to it if you aim to play me out." Stavrad took a turn at Peas in the Pot, and then at Sally Ann, and so on through his entire repertoire of six tunes. They were all dance figures, and even Stavrad knew them to be in poor keeping with the occasion. So he did his best to slow them down, but they refused to be somber, no matter how sluggish the tempo. When he was done, the girl had not yet died. "Play me another," she said. "I don't know no more," Stavrad said. "Well, that's pitiful," the girl said. "What kind of fiddler are you?" "Bum and shoddy," he said. That brought a quick smile to the girl's face, but the pain of it showed in her eyes and brought the corners of her mouth down quick. "Make me up a tune, then," she said. Stavrad marveled at such a strange request. It had never entered his mind to give composition a try. "I don't believe I could," he said. "Well, why not?" the girl said. "Have you never tackled it before?" "No." "Well, best get to it," she said. "Time's short." He sat thinking for a minute. He plucked the strings and retuned. He set the fiddle to his neck and struck the bow to it, and was himself surprised by the sounds that issued. The melody he spun out was slow and halting, and it found its mood mainly through drones and double stops. He could not have put a name to it, but the tune was in the frightening and awful Phrygian mode, and when the girl's mother heard it, she burst into tears and ran from her chair out into the hall. When he was done, the girl looked at Stavrad and said, "Now that was fine." "Wasn't neither," he said modestly. "Was," the girl said. She turned her face away, and her breathing grew wheezy and wet. The girl's father came to Stavrad and took him by the elbow and led him down to the kitchen. He sat him at the table and poured Stavrad a cup of milk and went back up the steps. By the time the cup was empty, the man had returned. "She's gone," he said. He took a federal dollar from his pocket and pressed it into Stavrad's hand. "You eased her way some up there," he said. Stavrad put the dollar in his shirt pocket and left. Time and again, during the walk back to camp, he stopped and looked at his fiddle as if for the first time. He had never before thought of trying to improve his playing, but now it seemed worthwhile to go at every tune as if all within earshot had been recently set afire. The music he had made up for the girl was a thing he had played every day since. He never tired of it, and, in fact, believed the tune to be so inexhaustible that he could play it every day for the rest of his life, learning something new each time. His fingers had stopped the strings, and his arm had drawn the bow in the shape of the tune so many times by now that he no longer thought about the playing. The notes just happened effortlessly. The tune had become a thing unto itself, a habit, that served to give order and meaning to a day's end, as some might pray, and others double-check the latch on the door, and yet others take a drink when night has fallen. From that day of the burning on, music came more and more into his mind. The war just didn't engage him anymore. He became casual in his attendance, and he was a little missed. He came to prefer spending as much of his time as he could manage in the dim regions of Richmond's taverns, rank places that smelled of unwashed bodies, spilled liquor, cheap perfume, and unemptied chamber pots. In truth, he had throughout the war spent as much time as he could afford in such places, but the difference now was that his main interest became the musical niggers that often played for the customers. Many a night Stavrod wandered from place to place, until he found a fellow working at a stringed instrument with authority, some genius of the guitar or banjo. Then he'd take out his fiddle and play until dawn, and every time he did he learned something new. He first spent his attention on matters of tuning and fingering and phrasing. Then he began listening to the words of the songs the niggers sang, admiring how they chanted out every desire and fear in their lives as clear and proud as could be. And he soon had a growing feeling that he was learning things about himself that had never sifted into his thinking before. One thing he discovered with a great deal of astonishment was that music held more for him than just pleasure. There was meat to it. The grouping of sounds, their forms in the air as they rang out and faded, said something comforting to him about the rule of creation. What the music said was that there is a right way for things to be ordered, so that life might not always be just tangle and drift, but have a shape, an aim. It was a powerful argument against the notion that things just happen. By now, he knew 900 fiddle tunes, some 100 of them being his own compositions. Ruby expressed doubt at the figure, pointing out that his two hands of fingers had always served his entire need for numerals in all other features of life. "He's never had enough of anything to have to count past 10," she said. 900 tunes, Stavrod said. "Well, play one," Ruby said. Stavrod sat and thought a minute, then he ran his thumb down the strings and twisted a peg, and tried them again and twisted other pegs, until he had achieved an exotic tuning with the E string run down about 3 frets so that it matched up with the 3rd note on the A string. "I've never stopped to name this one," he said, "but I reckon you could call it Green-Eyed Girl." When he set the bow to the new fiddle, the tone was startling in its clarity, sharp and pure, and the redundancy in the tuning led to curious and dissonant harmonic effects. The tune was slow and modal, but demanding in its rhythm and of considerable range. More than that, its melody constantly pressed upon you the somber notion that it was a passing thing, here and gone, unfixable. Yearning was its main theme. Ada and Ruby watched amazed as Stavrod spun out the music. He had apparently, at least for this forlorn piece, forsaken the short, choppy bow strokes of all known fiddlers, and was longbowing notes of great sweetness and stridency. It was music the like of which Ruby had never heard, nor for that matter had Ada. His playing was easy as a man drawing breath, yet with utter conviction in its centrality to a life worth claiming. When Stavrod finished and took the fiddle from under his gray stubble chin, there was a long silence in which the voices of peepers down by the creek sounded exceptionally sad and hopeful in the face of the coming winter. He looked at Ruby as if prepared for harsh evaluation. Ada looked at her too, and the expression on Ruby's face said it would take more than a tale and a fiddle tune to soften her heart toward him. She did not address him, but turned to Ada and said, "Might queer that this far on in life he's finally found the only tool he's ever shown any skill at working. A man so sorry he got his nickname from being beat half to death with a stob after he was caught stealing a ham." To Ada, though, it seemed akin to miracle that Stavrod, of all people, should offer himself up as proof positive that no matter what a waste one has made of one's life, it is ever possible to find some path to redemption, however partial. Bride Bed Full of Blood. Inman wandered the mountains for days, lost and befogged through a stretch of wretched weather. It seemed to rain from about the new moon to the full, though with the sky blanked out, who could tell, unless you thought to keep count of days, starting when the first drop fell. Inman had not seen sun, moon, or stars for at least a week, and would not have been surprised to find that for the entire time he had walked in circles, or in geometric figures more complex but equally directionless. To keep his course straight, he tried picking out points directly ahead of him, a certain tree or rock, to make for. He kept on at this until the thought occurred to him that the points he picked might all link up to make a big circle, and there seemed little to recommend walking in big ones to walking in little. So he went blindly through the fog, taking whatever tack he felt at that moment to be west, and tried to make himself content with just motion. He had used the goat woman's medicine until it was gone, and in short order the wounds at his head had become little puckered scars, and the place at his neck was a hard silver slash. The pain settled into a distant noise, like living by a river, one that he figured he could listen to indefinitely, but his thoughts had not healed with like speed. His haversack became empty of food. At first he hunted, but the high balsam woods seemed abandoned by game. Then he tried grabbling for crawfish to boil, but found that he worked for hours to catch enough to fill the crown of his hat, and then after eating them he felt he had gained little by it. He stripped the bark off an elm sapling and chewed it and then ate the cap to a ruby-colored boleet as big across as a frying pan. 15 minutes later he was again ravenous. He soon fell simply to drinking creek water out of cupped hands and pulling wild cress from stream margins. He found himself one afternoon crawling on the mossy ground of the creek bank, grazing at the water edge like a beast of the wild, his head wet to the ears, the sharp taste of cress in his mouth, and no idea whatsoever in his mind. He looked down into a pool and caught sight of his visage looking up at him, wavery and sinister, and he immediately frabbled his fingers in the water to break up the image, for he had no desire to look upon himself. "God, if I could sprout wings and fly," he thought, "I would be gone from this place, my great wings bearing me up and out, long feathers hissing in the wind. The world would unfurl below me like a bright picture on a scroll of paper, and there would be nothing holding me to ground. The watercourses and hills passing under me effortless and simple, and me just rising and rising till I was but a dark speck on the clear sky, gone on elsewhere, to live among the tree limbs and cliff rocks. Elements of humanity might come now and again like emissaries to draw me back to the society of people, unsuccessful every time, fly off to some high ridge and perch, observing the bright light of common day." He sat up and listened for a while to the talk of the creek on the round stones, the rain and the down leaves. A wet crow descended to a chestnut limb and tried to shake the water out of its feathers, and then sat hunched and ill-looking. Inman rose erect and went on bipedal, as was his fate, until he struck a little-used track. Sometime the next day, Inman began to feel that he was being followed. He wheeled around and saw a little hog-eyed man dressed in faded overalls and a black suit coat, walking noiselessly right up behind him. He could nearly have reached out and throttled the man by the neck. "Who the hell are you?" Inman said. The man skipped off into the trees, ducking behind a big tulip poplar. Inman walked over to the poplar and looked behind it. Nothing. He walked on, looking back behind him over and over. He'd spin, trying to catch the shadowy follower unawares, and sometimes the man would be there, hanging back in the trees. "He's finding my direction, and then he'll be off to tell the guard," Inman thought. He pulled out the lematz and waved it about. "I'll shoot you dead," Inman hollered to the woods. "Just watch me. I'll do it and not think twice. I'll blow a hole in your belly you could run a dog through." The hog-eyed man hung back, but followed on, flitting through the trees. Finally, as Inman rounded a bend in the road, the man stepped out from behind a rock ahead of him. "What the hell do you want?" Inman said. The little man put two fingers to his mouth and held him there a moment, and Inman recognized the gesture as one of the signs of the Red String Band, or the Heroes of America, he could not remember which. A volunteer worker in the hospital had passed along information about such sympathizers with the federal cause. They were all as bad as Masons for making up secret signals. Inman gave the counter signal of running one finger by his right eye. The little man smiled and said, "These are gloomy times." Inman knew this to be another code. The correct response would be to say, "Yes, but we expect better. Then the man would say, "Why?" And Inman would say, "Because we look for the cord of our deliverance." What Inman said instead was, "You can just stop right there. I'm not HOA or anything else. I've got no allegiances in that direction or in much of any other." "You an outlier?" the man said. "I would be if I was in a place fit for lying out." "Comes right down to cases," the man said. "I'm about as unaffiliated as you are. My boy got shot to death at Sharpsburg, and I've not give a pinch of shit for neither side since." "I attended the fight at Sharpsburg," Inman said. The man stuck out his hand and said, "Potts." Inman shook his hand and said his own name. "What was Sharpsburg like?" Potts said. "About like 'em all, but bigger than common," Inman said. "First they threw bombs among us and we among them. Then there was the charging and the shooting, grape shot and musket ball. Lots of boys died." They stood for a time, examining the nearby forest, and then Potts said, "You look worn to a nub." "Food's been scarce," Inman said, "and I've been walking hard as I can, which has been slow. I'd give you something to eat if I had any handy, but I don't. There's a good gal down the road 3 or 4 mile that will feed you and ask no questions." Rain fell slantwise and stinging on the wind. Inman wrapped himself in his groundcloth and walked on without slackening his pace. He looked cowled and robed as a pilgrim from days of yore, a dark monk out a wander for the good of his soul, seeking remedy in walking from being fouled by contact with the world. Rain dripped off his nose and into his beard. Within the hour he reached the house Potts had described, a lonesome little one-room cabin of squared-off timbers set above the road at the mouth to a dank cove. The windows were greased paper. Thin brown smoke rose from the mud and stick chimney and then whipped away on the wind. A hog shifted about in a pen up the hill. Roosting boxes for chickens in the corner between the house and chimney. Inman stepped up to the gate in the fence and yelled out his presence. The rain had become mixed with spitting ice. His two face cheeks felt pinched together such that they seemed to touch on the inside of his empty mouth. While he waited, he regarded a spice bush just on the other side of the fence, ice beginning to cling to the red berries. He yelled out again, and a young woman, a girl really, cracked the door and stuck her brown head out and then pulled it back in again. He heard the clack of a latch to secure the door. Afraid with good cause, Inman thought. He called out once more, this time adding that Potts had sent him for a meal. The door opened and the girl stepped out onto the porch. "Why didn't you say so?" she said. She was a pretty thing, little and slim and tight-skinned. She was brown-headed and wore a cotton-print dress, which ill-sorted with the bitter weather. Inman slipped the length of chain off the nail on the gatepost and walked up to the porch, unwrapping himself as he went. He shook the groundcloth out and draped it along the porch edge to drip. He took off the knapsack and haversack and set them on the porch in the dry. He stood there in the falling ice, waiting. "Well, come on up," she said. "I'll pay for what I eat," Inman said. He stepped onto the porch next to the woman. "I'm hard up, but not that far gone that I have to take money for what little I can offer. There's a pone of cornbread and some beans is all." She turned and walked into the house. Inman followed. The room was dark, lit by just the fire and the little brown light that came through the paper windows and fell on the scrubbed plank floor. But he could see that though it was bare as a barn, the room was clean. There was sparse furniture, a table, a pair of chairs, a cupboard, a rope bed. Other than a quilt on the bed, there was not a mark of ornament in the place, not a picture of a loved one, or of Jesus, or even an illustration cut from a magazine on the wall, as if herein great strictures toward graven images held sway. Nor was there even a little figurine on the mantel, or bow of ribbons tied to the hearth broom. The quilt alone stood as garnish to the eye. It was pieced together into no named pattern native to this country, not starflower, or flying bird, or churn dasher, or poplar leaf, but with some entirely made-up bestiary or zodiac of half-visionary creatures. Its colors were the dim tones of red and green and yellow that can be drawn from bark and flower and nuthull. Otherwise, there was not a speck of color but brown elsewhere in the cabin, except for the raw-skinned face of a recent baby that lay swaddled up tight in a cradle, crafted rudely from pine sticks, the bark still on. As he looked about the room, Inman was suddenly aware of his filth. In this clean, closed space, he found that his clothes threw a powerful reek from the gathered sweat of his long walking. His boots and pant legs were caked muddy to the shins, and he left tracks as he stepped. He considered taking the boots off, but feared that his socks would stink like rotted meat. It had been some time since he had last gone unshod. The cabin was not an old one, and still held a faint, crisp smell of dressed timbers, chestnut and hickory, and Inman felt marked and at odds with their bouquet. The woman pulled one of the chairs to the side of the fire and gestured for him to sit. In a minute, a faint steam had begun to rise around him from his sodden clothes, and little puddles of muddy water had dripped from his cuffs onto the floorboards. He looked down at his feet and noted that a half-circle of puncheon was scuffed and worn pale around the front of the hearth, the way a dog on a rope will beat down the dirt at the perimeter of its range. The pot of pinto beans swung by its bale on an iron rod to the side of the fire. A fresh round of cornbread rested in a Dutch oven on the hearth. The woman served him up a plate heaped high with beans and bread and a big peeled onion. She set a pail of spring water and a dipper down next to him. "You can eat at the table or here. It's warmer here," she said. Inman took the plate and a knife and spoon into his lap and fell to eating. A part of him wished to be polite, but it was overcome by some dog organ deep in his brain, and so he ate loudly and in gulps, pausing to chew only when absolutely necessary. He forewent slicing the onion and ate on it like an apple. He spooned the hot beans into his mouth and gnawed the wedges of greasy bread at such a rate that he alarmed even himself. The liquor of the beans dripped off his beard and onto the front of his filthy shirt. His breath came short and whistled in his nose from lack of regular breathing. With some effort, he slowed down his chewing. He drank a dipper full of the cold spring water. The woman had pulled the chair to the other side of the hearth and sat watching him, as one would a boar feeding on carrion, that is to say, with a certain measure of fascinated disgust. "I'm sorry, I've not taken actual food in days, just wild cress and creek water," he said. "It's no need to be sorry," she said, in such an even tone that Inman could not interpret whether in that last word she had meant to absolve or admonish. Inman looked at her closely for the first time. She was indeed just a pale, slim girl here alone in this dark hollow where the sun would never shine bright for long. Her life so bare that she lacked buttons, for he noted that the top of her dress was held to with a long briar from a cockspur bush. "How old are you?" Inman said. 18, she said. "Name's Inman. Yours?" "Sarah," she said. "How do you come to be here all alone?" "My man John went off for the fighting," she said. "He died a while back. They killed him up in Virginia. He never saw his baby, and it's just us two now." Inman sat silent for a minute, thinking that every man that died in that war, on either side, might just as soon have put a pistol against the soft of his palate and blown out the back of his head for all the meaning it had. "Have you got any help here?" he said. "Not a lick." "How do you make it?" "I take a push plow and do what I can to lay me out a little patch of corn and a kitchen garden around the side of the hill a piece, though neither one didn't make much this year. I've got a tub mill to grind up the corn in, and there's a few chickens for the eggs. We had us a cow, but the raiders came over the mountain and took it off back in the summer and burnt down what little shed of a barn there was and robbed the bee gums and took a hatchet and broke open a blue-tick hound we had right out there on the porch to scare me. That big hog in the pen is mostly it for the winter. I've got to slaughter it soon, and I dread it, because I've never killed hogs on my own yet." "You'll need help," Inman said. She seemed such a slight thing to be butchering hogs. She said, "Needin' and gettin' don't seem likely to match up any time soon. All my family's dead now, and there's no neighbors around here I can ask but Potts, and he's no help at all when it comes to work. What needs doing is mine to do." She would be old in 5 years from such a load, and recognizing this, Inman wished he had not set foot in this house, wished he had kept walking, even if it meant falling by the wayside never to rise again. He saw with sorrow that hers was a life he could step right into and keep working at hard from tonight till death. If he allowed himself to ponder it for a minute, he saw all the world hanging over the girl like the deadfall to a trap, ready to drop and crush. It was near dark outside now, and the room was murky as a bear den, except for the wedge of yellow light cast by the fire. The girl's legs were stretched out before her to the heat. She had on a thick pair of gray men's socks turned down at the ankles, and her dress hem had risen so that he could see, shining in the firelight, fine golden hairs lying flat and soft against the skin at the sides of her narrow calves. So disordered was his mind from the past day's fasting that he thought to stroke it like the neck of a nervous horse one would seek to calm, for he could see etched in every angle of her body all the lineaments of despair. "I could help," Inman discovered himself to be saying. "It's some early, but this would pass for hog-killing weather." "I couldn't ask it," the girl said. "You didn't ask it," Inman said. "I offered." "I'd have to trade you something," she said. "I could clean and mend those clothes of yours. It's not like they don't need it. That big rent in the coat could use a wedge sewed over it. Meanwhile, you could put on clothes my man left. He was about as long as you are." Inman bent and ate some more from the plate in his lap, and shortly he mopped up the last juice with a crust of cornbread and finished it off. Without asking, Sarah spooned him up another pile of beans and forked out a wedge of bread. The baby commenced crying. While he worked on the second plate of food, she went back into the dim of the room and unbuttoned her dress near to the waist and nursed the baby sitting sideways on the bed to Inman. He wished not to look, but could nevertheless see the round side of her breast, full and luminous white in the grainy light. In a while she pulled the baby off, and a point of firelight caught on the end of her wet nipple. When she returned to the hearth, she carried a stack of folded clothes, with a clean pair of good boots standing atop them. He handed her the empty plate, and she put the clothes and boots in his lap. "You can go out on the porch and put these on, and use this." She handed him water in a basin made from the bottom of a gourd, a chunk of gray soap, and a rag. He stepped out into the night. There was a washboard at the end of the porch, and on the post above the board hung a little round mirror of polished metal going to rust. Young John's shaving place. Fine ice still rattled on the dry leaves clinging yet to the black oaks, but at the open end of the hollow he could see breaking clouds scudding across the face of the moon behind them. Inman thought about the dog the raiders had killed on the porch, the girl watching. He stripped off in the cold, and the clothes he removed were like skinned pelts, wet and heavy and limp. He did not look in the mirror, but scrubbed hard at himself with the soap and rag. He poured the remainder of the gourd water over his head, and then he dressed. The dead man's clothes were a fair fit, soft and thin from much washing, and the boots fit like they were cut to his feet, though all in all he felt he had donned the husk of another life. When he re-entered the cabin, he felt as a ghost must, occupying the shape of the past to little effect. Sarah had lit a tallow dip and was at the table washing dishes in a basin. The air around the light seemed thick. All the bright objects close to it appeared haloed. Everything in the shadows beyond it was extinguished completely, as if never to reappear. The curve of the girl's back as she bent over the table seemed to Inman a shape not to be duplicated in all the time stretched out before him, a thing to fix in mind and hold, so that should he become an old man, the memory might be useful, not a remedy against time, but nevertheless a consolation. He sat again at the chair by the hearth. Soon the girl joined him, and they sat quiet, staring into the red fire. She looked up at him, her face an unreadable, lovely blank. "If I had a barn, you could sleep there," she said, "but I don't now." "The corn crib will do fine," Inman said. She looked back into the fire, as if to dismiss him, and Inman walked out onto the porch again and collected his packs and his sodden bedding and walked behind the house to the crib. The clouds were breaking in earnest, and the near landscape was gathering and starting to form up under the light of the revealed moon. The air was chilling off toward a hard freeze. Inman climbed into the crib and burrowed up with his blankets as best he could into the cobs. Up the cove an owl called out a number of times, the calls descending the scale. The hog stirred and snuffled and then fell silent. Inman figured it to be a bleak and knobby night of sleep coming on, but all in all favorable in contrast to stretching out on the bare ground. Bars of blue moonlight came in between the crib slats, and Inman could see to take the lamats from the haversack and check its 10 loads and rub it down with the tail of the dead man's shirt and set it to half-cock. He took out his knife and stropped its edge against the clean leather of a boot sole, and then he rolled up in the blankets to sleep. But he had slept little before he was wakened by footsteps in the leaves. He reached and set his hand on the pistol, moving slowly so as not to rattle the cobs. The step stopped a dozen feet from the crib. "Come inside, please," Sarah said, and she turned and walked away. Inman clambered out and stood and slid the pistol inside the waist of the pants and cast back his head to survey the narrow slot of sky. Orion was fully risen and seemed to bestride the close ridge lines at either side of the cove with the sure demeanor of one who knows his own mind and follows it. Inman walked on back to the house, and as he approached it, he saw that the paper windows glowed like a Japanese lantern. Inside he found that the girl had fed the fire with hickory logs, and it blazed high, and the room was as bright and warm as it would ever be. She was in bed, and had taken the plait out of her hair, and it spread thick across her shoulders and shone in the light. Inman walked to the hearth and set the pistol up on a little shelf that served for mantle. The crib was drawn up near the fire, and the baby slept face down, so that all could be seen was a pale fuzzed orb arising from covers. "You look like an outlaw with that big pistol," she said. "I'm not sure there's a thing I am right now that you could set a name to," Inman said. "If I was to ask you to do something, would you do it?" she said. Inman considered that he should frame an answer here on the order of maybe, or if I can, or some like provisional phrase. What he said was, "Yes." "If I was to ask you to come over here and lay in bed with me but not do a thing else, could you do it?" Inman looked at her there and wondered what she saw looking back, some dread shape filling the clothes of her husband, a visitation of spirit, half desired, half feared. His eyes rested on the quilt over her. Its squares depicted blocky beasts, big-eyed and little-legged, awkward but heraldic. They seemed patched together out of partial remembrances of dream animals, their shoulders humped with muscle, feet bristling with spikes, howling mouths stretched wide and filled with long teeth. "Could you?" she said. "Yes," Inman said. "I believed you could, or I'd never have asked." He went to the bed and drew off the boots and climbed under the quilts fully clothed and lay under the covers flat on his back. The tick over the rope was filled with fresh straw and smelled dry and autumnal and sweet, and underlying that was the smell of the girl herself, like a stand of wet laurels after their blooms have fallen to the ground. They both kept as still as if a charged and cocked shotgun rested there between them, and then in a few minutes Inman heard her crying great dry sobs. "I'll go if that would be better," he said. "Hush," she said. She cried on a while, and then stopped and sat up and wiped her eyes on the quilt corner and began talking about her husband. She required of Inman only that he bear witness to her tale. Every time he went to speak, she said, "Hush." There was nothing about her story remarkable, other than that it was her life. She told the manner in which she and John had met and fallen in love, the building of this cabin, and her working like a man beside him, felling the trees and raising the dressed logs and chinking the gaps. The happy life they had planned in this lost place, which to Inman seemed so unlikely of sustenance. The hardness of the past 4 years, John's death, the shortness of food. The only bright spot was John's brief furlough, a time of great happiness, which produced the baby sleeping by the fire. "Without her," Sarah said, "there'd be nothing holding me to earth." The final thing she said was, "That will be a good hog out there. It fed on chestnut mast mainly, and I brought it in from the woods and gave it corn for the past 2 weeks so the lard will render out clear. It's so fat its eyes have about swole shut." When she was done talking, she reached out and touched the scar at Inman's collar line, first with just her fingertips and then with her whole palm. She rested her hand there a moment, and then she took it away. She rolled over with her back to him, and soon her breathing became deep and regular. He figured she had found some calm just in telling to another person what a lonely thin edge of life she occupied, where one hog could act as stopple to a demijohn of woes. Worn as he was, Inman could not rest. While Sarah slept, he lay looking up, watching the light of the fire diminish on the underside of the roof as the logs burned away. A woman had not touched a hand to him with any degree of tenderness in so long that he had come to see himself as another kind of creature altogether from what he had been. It was his lot to bear the penalty of the unredeemed, that tenderness be forevermore denied him, and that his life be marked down a dark mistake. And in his troubled mind and constant sorrow, he did not even think it possible to reach a hand to Sarah's hip and pull her to him and hold her close till daylight. What little sleep he did get was troubled by dreams that emanated from the quilt top. The beasts of it chased after him in a dark wood, and there was not place one for sanctuary, no matter where he turned. All the world of that dark realm gathered dire and intent against lone him, and everything about it was gray and black, but for teeth and claws as white as the moon. When Inman awoke, it was to Sarah.